Hello, and welcome to Speak On It, History and Genealogy Conversations with Janice and Sharicana. We invite you to join us on Thursdays at 8 p.m. for an engaging exchange with us and our special guest as we cover various topics regarding history, genealogy, and your personal family history stories. Hello, I'm Janice Gilliard.
And I'm Sharicana Feliciano. Welcome to Speak On It, History and Genealogy Conversations with Janice and Sharicana. Thank you for joining us. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Today, we're joined by our guest, Dr. Brittany Brown.
Dr. Brittany Brown is from Jacksonville, Florida. She earned her Bachelor of Arts from the University of Florida with a major in anthropology. While attending the University of Florida, she completed her undergraduate fieldwork at Kingsley Plantation in Jacksonville, Florida. She earned her Master of Arts and her PhD in anthropology from the College of William and Mary.
Brittany is an American historical archaeologist. Her regional areas of specialization include the African American Southeast and the British Caribbean. Her current research interests include post-emancipation era mortuary practices among African Americans in Jacksonville, Florida, and maritime archaeology. Welcome to Speak On It, Dr. Brittany Brown.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being here. We're so excited. All right, so let's jump right in. As we stated in your bio, your research focuses includes mortuary practices of post-emancipation era African-Americans in Jacksonville, Florida, which sounds really fascinating. What drew you to focus your research on that topic? And what are some mortuary practices you've learned about through your research?
So originally, I started out in cemetery work in a plantation context. And so my first exposure to African American or African diaspora burial grounds was in a plantation context. And that really gave me sort of my love of cemeteries and Black mourning and commemorative practices in general. And so for my dissertation, I wanted to expand my knowledge beyond plantation archaeology. And there is sort of a call to expand our understanding of Black cultural production beyond what people were doing in bondage. And so I really wanted to do some of that with my dissertation work. And so that's what got me started. And so some of the things that I learned while studying the cemeteries in my hometown is that while we kept many of our old ways, what the old people call our old ways of commemoration, the placing the shell on the ground, the placing of the bed frames, we've found new ways or new materials with which to do that. Mm-hmm. And that also our commemorative materials as Black communities continue to be displaced with time, whether that's urban renewal, pushing people out via eminent domain, and all of these things that are happening to our communities, the job opportunities that are not there for us that make us move to other cities, or the lynchings that forced us from the South to the North. With that, our commemorative materials become as transit as we are. Mm-hmm. And so that's something that the burial space has taught me. So yeah.
That's amazing. And I'm like, I feel like there's a reason why I was kind of like drawn your work, because I did a cemetery project in New Jersey and started researching cemeteries in New Jersey. And, you know, a lot of people don't equate slavery with Jersey, but it happened here, right?
Absolutely.
And, you know, to your point about, you know, displacement and how neighborhoods change, you know, that was one of the issues, you know, when I was researching, is that, you know, abandonment and neglect of cemeteries, you know, becomes an issue as the neighborhoods change. And as, you know, a lot of times Black neighborhoods are dealing with gentrification and quote unquote urban renewal, and they get pushed out. And so the folks that are connected and buried in that land, you know, their descendants now are no longer there. So it's a robust field. And man, I can't imagine the stuff you must have like learned and researched along the way. That's really dope.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's very connected to sort of policy also. So it really pushed me into sort of getting into understanding the policy of how cemeteries are maintained and how preservation funds are allocated and what professionals in the field find as valuable sites to preserve. And so that's something that I kept running up against. And I don't know if you know, but there's something like less than, I want to say about less than 1% of us that are archaeologists that are Black. And then probably even less than that in the historic preservation space. So there's not a lot of Black professionals in general. And so when it comes to preserving our spaces, that's something you run into. In addition to the training, like there's not a lot of Euro-American professionals that specifically are trained to look at African-American material culture. And so you get these people with all these different backgrounds who don't necessarily know exactly what they're looking at or what to look for in terms of space. And so that's something, because our ancestors, they implemented material culture, but they also were using the landscape. And that's a very African way of shaping the space commemoratively, is to use plants and landscape and things like that. And that's something you also find in cemeteries. So yeah, it's been a journey.
Wow, that's beautiful.
As we said earlier, we love what you're doing, Dr. Brown. So what made you choose the field of archaeology?
Ooh, now that's a long, I'm gonna try to keep that one brief. So, what made me choose archaeology is I was dabbling in it sort of in college, trying to figure out what my major was. I graduated very early, so I came into undergrad as a junior, and so I had to declare my undergraduate major pretty early, because I already had like an AA degree coming in, and I was going to graduate early, so I needed to pick a major. So originally, I had chosen something else, and then I got exposed to anthropology in the classroom, and then we had our first field school in my hometown. There, I uncovered the Captive African Cemetery. They had been looking for this cemetery for decades, like since the 60s. I happened to uncover that. And just the way I saw Black people being treated on that site, not just what I experienced personally as a Black student doing the archaeology, but also the way my community was treated, because that was my hometown. Like those people were my people. The way I saw us being treated, I was like, immediately that needs to change, immediately. And right there and then on that plantation is where I decided I'm gonna create a seat for myself at this table. So next time that this I brush up against this, my voice will be bigger. My name will hold weight, and those letters do that for me. Get me in the door. And they position me in a way that I'm able to use anthropology as a shield for our communities. Because it can be a weapon, it can be weaponized against our communities, or it can be a shield. And I was like, immediately, no, immediately, all of that needs to change. The way the community was treated, the way the archaeology was done, the things that I experienced, all of that needed to change immediately.
So let me ask you this, right, with your response. And Terracotta is going to go, there she goes, right? So you had to choose a major, but with the situation that you encountered, do you ever feel like, you know what, they chose me? Like
I
a
do,
kind of like
I
a
do.
spiritual type thing, like,
Yeah,
you're
I do.
there
I
and
do
you're
feel like
moved
that.
by it, and then there's this connection, and then you're like, oh no, it's not going down like this. So do you feel like there was this, okay, I'm choosing it, but this situation, it's also choosing me. My ancestors are also choosing me, or the folks that are here, the ancestors are choosing me. They may not necessarily be, well, were they connected to you? You said these are my people. Were they actually connected to you as well?
So I'm not necessarily that I know about. I'm not a descendant of Kingsley Plantation, but historically, my mother's people, her father had roots in Maryland. We talked about that earlier. But her mother's mother, her people had roots in North Carolina, and they had roots in Jacksonville. So her people have been in that space, been in Jacksonville City since the 1800s. So I do have ties to the community in that way. And so when I say my people there, I mean like I was a local person who just kind of stumbled into having access to this site via my program. There's not a lot of Black people at University of Florida in general, and there wasn't a lot of people from my city there. And so it's happenstance that I'm here. So yes, I had connections to the site, but also the way I was able to read the landscape, I grew up going to that plantation as a, it's a national park. I grew up going to that plantation as, you know, learning my history and my heritage and what slavery was. And so I grew up with that site. And then coming back and being able to sort of excavate it as an undergraduate was, it was a special place to me. Like it held a special place for me. And I think
Wow.
that me being in that space and being able to read the landscape different
Right.
than my white counterparts is the reason why I was able to even locate that cemetery space. And I think
Right.
we're just now getting into a place in the field where we're starting to move towards understanding African ways of knowing space and shaping space with landscape. That was a long answer to say
Oh,
yes.
no, it's a great answer.
Like a lot of Black scholars who come to the, not all of us, because you got a little, you got some funkiness going on. But a lot of us that, a lot of Native people, Indigenous people, Black people that come to this discipline, they're called to this discipline, to step up as cultural stewards of their communities. And you'll find us in a lot of places, especially the ones that sort of stay in places they have ties to. That's for a reason. It's not an accident. They're moving with intention through this discipline, and they're actually going to get tools to put in their arsenal.
Right. That's a great answer. Actually, something before we get to the next question, and you kind of had already touched on it with regards to your familial ties to the region, but something you said about anthropology being used sometimes as a weapon against Black people. And it reminded me of, I think it was Zora Neale Hurston's, they did like a documentary of hers, and I believe she studied anthropology, and she said the same thing because she talked about that role and having to be careful of using anthropological skills in a way that was actually helpful to Black people and not in a way that, made Black people like these subjects, which is typically how it is. So when you said that, that really dawned on me. And she was very much about, capturing Black folks in their raw form, so to speak, right? How they spoke, no, we're not gonna change it. This is the dialect. This is how they are. And so that's really an interesting position to be in, I think, as not only a Black person doing anthropology, but then when you come back to the community that you're from that made you, and now using those tools in a way that's helpful as opposed to like harmful for your people. That was a really poignant point that you made, and I'm glad you said that. Now you did mention your familial ties to the region. In Jacksonville. So just yeah, share with us a little bit more about your background, how you're connected to the folks in Jacksonville and so forth.
Yeah, so my mom had my mom has a saying. She's like, everywhere that you are, you've already been. And so it's kind of a nod to how we circle back. We're drawn to spaces and we don't know why. And then we find out later that we have these deep connections or deep roots in the land. So my mother's side, because they've been in one place the longest. My dad's people, they kind of moved around, but they're mostly South Carolina based, South Carolina on his mother's side and Alabama on his father's side. And then they ended up, you know, starting their own life in Ohio. So there's a
Oh,
big
wow.
them that are in Ohio. But they have roots in the South, as Black people usually do, you know. And
Yes.
then my mother's father's side, they stayed in Maryland the longest. So they, and I think he's like a local treasure. I gotta go get his oral history from my mom in Harford County, because
Wow.
his family has been there since at least 1790s, at least. And the ancestor that was in 1790 was like 36. So they've been here for a while, in Maryland. And then my mother's people, her great grandmother was born in Jacksonville. And
Okay.
so her people had moved from North Carolina to Jacksonville shortly after emancipation. So during that time, Jacksonville was kind of like a bustling, upcoming Black town. It was a Black majority. It was like a economic powerhouse. We had the first Black millionaire in the state there, a lot of
Wow.
business there. And my mother's ancestor married into a famous Black family, the Andersons. And they actually have a picture of him in the African American History Museum in D.C.
Oh,
He was
wow.
he owned a lot of he owned oystering. He did oystering, and he did a lot of the, his family did a lot of business. Charlotte Anderson, his mother, was very She was a very keen businesswoman, and they ran with like Mary McLeod Bethune and all of these A.L.
Down in
Lewis,
Florida, yeah.
all down in Florida, all Booker T. Washington. So they were like a black elite,
Right.
and they just kind of stayed in the city, and some of the branches moved back up to North Carolina, and and married into Maryland. That's where my branch did, from North Carolina, married somebody from Maryland, and kind of integrated in there. And there's a branch that stayed down here, and so yeah.
Wow. Okay, so you got like a nice mix of folks.
Yeah.
And you don't hear too much about I mean, and maybe it's because I'm not like familiar with Jacksonville and Florida history, but that's the almost like an opposite or migration. So from North Carolina to Florida, so from like sort of the middle south to the deep south, that's really
Right.
interesting.
So that's what I think, and that's a key part of history I think is missing, because there are several times in history where you can find black folks running south. They're running
Right.
south to freedom, you know, because Spanish Florida, Florida wasn't American until 1821. So up until that point, it was a very free place for black people. Spain had incentivized, hey, if y'all run down here, we'll give you freedom and we'll give you some guns to keep the British up out of our space. And so a lot of black people ran to Florida. And then it happened again, after the Civil War, because there was economic opportunity. Black folks in Jacksonville had it was a pivotal moment for them to remake the image in this remake the city in a black majority. There was a point after the Civil War where they could reimagine and make the city, you know, live up to what they were supposed to get after slavery, and they did that. Like, those were some movers and shakers. I
Yeah.
give them that. They were moving some money. They were buying some land. They were creating their own auxiliary organizations, providing their own people with housing and food and jobs. And they would put together programs for vocational training, and then they'd take those folks and then they'd employ them in their businesses. And so those they were doing some moving. And W.E.B. Du Bois was writing about how well they were doing and how they were the pinnacle of black society. And
And the Crisis Magazine.
yes,
Get that
ma'am.
Crisis Magazine so you can find a lot. You're proving a point that we keep stressing in our OGS meetings and all. With Black people, if we're not like everybody, sometimes people say, oh, it was just slavery. We had more than one experience, and everybody wasn't enslaved and everybody wasn't poor. So there's so many different stories to tell. So there were, yes, there were challenges throughout the country, but then there were pockets, like you said, come to Florida, we'll give you land, we'll give you freedom. There's so many different stories. It's just not one story when it comes to our people. And you just proved that.
Yeah, and I think it's important because Florida, the state, is just so disruptive for all of those types of histories. I mean, the 1619 Project, it was big and it was good, but I think in a lot of people's minds, it kind of confirmed for them that that was our point of origin as a people, and it really wasn't. Like, the first black presence in what is now the United States happened in Florida in 1513, and he was free. So there's a lot of points at which Florida sort of disrupts dominant narratives about who Black people are in this new world space.
That's
And then
deep.
when we talk about our point of inception for even the new world, it begins in 1492, but then nobody wants to talk about how North Africans came into Spain and held it from 711 until 1492. We just pick up in 1492. But all of the things that North Africans brought into Spain was transported by North Africans and West Africans who came to the New World. All of their laws, all of their miscegenation policies, all of the things that they were doing, they transported that into the New World in 1492. But it's just something we don't talk about. It's just not
No,
more than one story. More than one story.
not at
Right. More
all.
than one story, for sure.
You have a lot of histories and stories there. Like, oh my goodness. Once again,
Yeah.
the podcast proves to be my classroom.
So, Dr. Brown, on your Instagram page, you sometimes post pictures of yourself heading in the field. What is field work like for you? Can you give us a day in the life of breakdown of being an archaeologist in the field?
Wow. So being an It's hard because it's almost like each project is different. Each phase offers different challenges and different rewards. Some days you're in the field, some days you are in the lab. So each day looks different. Like a lab day for me would look different. And it depends on the type of archaeology. So I've done academia, which is a more slow paced, over a long period of time archaeology. And then I've done CRM work, which is very fast paced and sometimes is one phase at a time, that they're assigned to or working on. But if I can think back to one day, in archaeology, that looks like suit getting suited and booted.
I've seen a picture of you do
Okay, suited and
that.
booted. You want your long shirt, long cotton shirt. Sounds hot in Florida, but you're gonna need that for the mosquitoes. You want your cargo pants, snake boots, because we have moccasins. We are in a swamp with the gators and all of that. So you definitely
Ooh.
want waterproof snake
You
boots.
are my shiro because I would get an F and it'd be like, nope, this is not working for me. Alligators, I'm done.
And if you have heavy brush, and this is why it depends. So plantations now, that's settled land, that's open land. Your cute little ponytail, your cute little scarf, going into the woods, unsettled, you're trying to discover a site, you might need a ski mask and a wig cap.
Cow.
Braid it on back, put it up under a wig cap, put your ski mask on,
Wow.
and get you a machete. You might have to cut some things down. So,
Have
and
you ever been
you
bit by anything or like you ever had a run-in with
yeah.
something?
Yeah, not a snake though. I don't fool with the snakes. 'Cause sometimes, you would think they'll be on the ground with your boots. That's where you want them to be. But really they just kind of hang out in the trees. Like they'll wrap themselves around the bush and then you gotta walk through the bush, but you can't see the snake because they blend, because that's what they're supposed to do. Blend.
I'm trying to refrain from commenting, but my story would be, they'd be like, oh, she was a nice lady. I would just die right there.
I'm about to say the title of this
I'm
podcast is
out.
going to be,
I
Dr. Brittany
mean,
Brown, archaeologist, but we don't fool with no snakes.
some of them bugs are like Jurassic Park size bugs. Like, I'm like, somebody, the archaeology is one, some of y'all need to be out here studying why these bugs are so big. Like, the spiders are like the size of my hand big. Like, they're huge. They're huge
Like, I
spiders.
remember one time when I was in the Deep South, I was in Mississippi visiting family one summer, and like it blew my mind because, and I guess this is common in certain parts of the world, in certain parts of the United States, but in this season, the trees are just basically one big spider web. Like,
Yeah.
just what, and it was to this day, I'll never, like, it was like a seared visual in my mind. And as a child, it was just so like, whoa, like, what is going
God
on
bless
out
the
here?
crew that has to go through that and survey that, because somebody got to do it. Because people, there's archaeologists before you get to, breaking up the land and stuff, it has to be evaluated. So somebody got to go up in there. I don't know who it's going to be, but like in Florida, we have biodiversity, got coyotes, bears, snakes, alligators, in addition to all the biting flies, bugs, chiggers, all
Y'all
types
like
of
the
stuff.
Australia of United States.
It's interesting up in there. It's interesting. Ran into some
Wow.
gators, ran into some bears, a couple coyotes. So head on
That's
a swivel.
fascinating.
Head
Yes,
on a
right.
swivel.
Another possible title for the podcast. Head on swivel. Okay,
Wow.
so that kind of leads us into the next question. What's been some of your most memorable archaeological experiences or expeditions?
I think some of my most memorable ones, not because it's clear land, but plantation spaces, cemetery spaces are very hallowed ground to me. So my most memorable moments have been in those spaces. I think I've uncovered the most interesting things in those spaces. But also just the experience of being in those spaces. I've been to lynching sites, not necessarily looking for anything specific, but more so to sort of gather how a community would want to commemorate, what we could do with the space for commemoration, which is also a part of what we do, and bringing people to specific sites to have them do libations and pay respects. So always sites where Black life was lost. I'll say that. I can, because I think that's a common thread in my work. Like, even in the diving, to me, captive African shipwrecks are like underwater cemeteries. There's so many people that have taken their last breath in the ocean itself, who are down there. That is the last, that is their site of resting. That's the only thing that we have left to point to where they've last been. So for me, it's been, sites where black life has been lost, for me, and whatever form that takes. So lynching sites, cemeteries, shipwrecks, all of these things are probably my most memorable. Just
Wow.
even being in those spaces, even if you don't find anything, even if you're not there to find anything, even if the community doesn't want you to, besides it, hey, we don't want you to break ground. This is hollow ground to us. We don't need you to dig anything up. Just being in those spaces does something for me spiritually, I think.
Wow.
Yeah.
Powerful. Very powerful. So, Dr. Brown, what would you say to any young Black women who are considering the field of archaeology?
Real answer, buckle up. This
And
is the
yet
top.
another title for the
This
podcast.
buckle up, buttercup. This is the time, because you and I would say, I first of all, bless you, welcome, but also understand that you are coming to the academy to have your credentials valued, validated, and not your humanity, and not your personhood, and not your identity. And I think Black women, when they come to this field, they be catching hell. Really and truly. And so it's important to remember, you are not coming to have any of your personhood, identity, humanity validated. You are coming to have your credentials validated. And that is it. That is all. And as long as you keep that, and find your people. Find your people. There are people that are supportive. There might be one per department. Find it. Create a Zoom. Join spaces.
No, that's
Do
good advice.
you, and to piggyback off of that, do you have young ladies that come up and are like, they find out what you do and they're fascinated with it or very, very interested in it? Or young people, I'm saying young women, but young male and female, youth rather, that are fascinated by the work that you do.
So yeah, yes, I do, and I think it's because I don't look like what they think an archaeologist should look like, so they're shocked. And they, when I was growing up, I wasn't a thing. Like, nobody exposed me to archaeology. You had the doctor, lawyer, nurse, maybe a beautician or two in there, but we didn't get the full gambit. And I understand it, why the structural reasons are for that. So when I do come across the youth and I tell them what I do, they're a lot of the time shocked, curious. They want to know what I do with my hair when I dive. They want to know how I'm digging with these long nails. They want to know all the things. Yeah, I do run across girls who are inspired. And even if they don't go into necessarily archaeology, they're like, well, shoot, what else are we out here doing? Like, what else are people doing? Maybe I could do this and maybe I could do that. And so it does kind of open them up in a way, for sure. The boys too, but mostly I mostly have an audience of women.
And I mean, to your point, you don't look like what people envision an archaeologist to be like. We're used to Indiana Jones, older white men. I was going to ask you too, what are some like the core courses, like what kind of classes do you have to take for archaeology? What are the sciences or any math or things like that?
So, statistics is always encouraged, math wise. But so you basically can major secret. I mean, anthropology degree is preferred, but you can basically major in whatever you want undergrad wise and then go to grad school. You just want to make sure you have enough courses. So you want to take like intro to cultural anthropology. In America, and which is different from England. England has its own, they have their own archaeology thing. But in America, we have a four subfield approach. So there's cultural anthropology, there's bio, there's linguistics, and there's archaeology. you have to master three out of the four. That was William and Mary's deal. You have to master three and you have to prove it. We had a qualifying examination in those respective.
Wow.
So some of the things that I had to take were like labs, learning how to identify, catalog, sort artifacts. I took theory, so archaeological theory. There's theories and techniques and methodologies that we use. So arc theory, arc method, learning the field methods. You can take curation, learn how to put together museum exhibits and things like that. And definitely field schools. So learning how to run a field school, learning how to actively participate in a field school. So you start as a participant, and then as you go higher, you learn how to run the field school, how to put together the inventory list of what you need, how to manage everything, apply for grants and get it funded, and all
Right.
those things. And then the ethics. So you want to learn ethics and policies. And so, yeah, those are just some of the things.
Just
So was
some of the
there,
things, a
yeah,
lot of
some of
things.
the things.
Was there ever a time that you were like, oh, I think I missed my calling? Or, throughout your journey with this, right, that you were just like, yeah, I'm supposed to do this all the way through. Like, was there ever a time that you questioned, okay, wait a minute, is this really my purpose and calling? I'm just curious. It doesn't sound like it, but I'd like to know if you ever thought
All the time.
that.
Listen, I'm questioning it right now. No, I'm like, when it gets hard and it's really hard, you just like, God, I know you don't think I'm supposed to be out here struggling like this, you know?
Right,
But
right, right.
is it is you always get a little nudge of this is what you're supposed to be doing, and here it is. So you always get affirmation. It does get hard though, and so it's not so much questioning, is this what I'm supposed to be doing? But am I doing it correctly? Am I doing it efficiently?
Right. Am I supposed to be doing it like this?
Am I supposed to be doing it like this? Could I do it better? Yeah, that's nobody's ever asked me that, but you do get a lot of self-doubt and imposter syndrome. Like, should I be doing it on this level? Are you sure it's supposed to be me up here?
Well,
Was it supposed to be
yeah.
like
There's another reason why I asked that
this?
question because there aren't that many women of color that are doing what you're doing. I feel
Yeah.
like you're paving the way. So it may be challenging and difficult at times, but somebody else coming behind you, you'll be able to encourage them and say, if I can do it, you can do it. And hey, there's a better way for you to do it. Try this. So I feel like maybe some of the challenges that you have are going to benefit other people coming behind you.
Yeah,
I think you're real genius.
I do grapple with that a lot, and that's why I went and I founded the Association for Black Feminist Anthropology, and I want that to really be a space where Black women from across all the sub-disciplines of anthropology, archaeology, linguistics, bio, cultural, can come together and congregate and still share and help each other with their resumes and build each other up and provide support, because we are more than our academic journey also. So sometimes
Wow.
we don't have space to sort of, because when you talk about your experience, it comes off like whiny, right? Like, I can
Right.
say this racist, but then you gonna make, because I'm the only person here, I'll become the problem
Right.
versus exposing an issue that needs to change. You yourself are now the problem and therefore a target. And I think when you create spaces, and that's another thing, all Black spaces are not safe spaces for all Black people.
Especially if you're dealing with gatekeepers.
Especially if you're dealing with gatekeepers, because one thing white supremacy teaches you is that there's room for only one, maybe two at the top, and that's not it. It's not it for me. So I think, like, you, my thing is, when you get a chance, you kick the door down and you just let the gates open. Everybody's running in at the same time, you know, because that's how you create change. But I have also a recognition of there are people in this discipline that do gatekeep, and they do want to be the only one because they feel like there can only be one.
And I fight against that because our ancestors didn't go through everything they went through for there to be only one. And you said something, you said we are more than our academic journey. And then to piggyback off of that, if you are the only one, like you said, you're supposed to kick the door open for other folks to come behind you to make a difference. It's not supposed to be, oh, I'm the only one, and you find pride in that.
I mean, like, okay, that's nice, but then what are you doing for those coming behind you?
Yeah.
You gotta embody them politics. Those liberatory, restorative justice politics. Sometimes we get on podiums and we speak about it, and it sounds cool, especially when you're in a room with people that don't look like you. But there has to be a code of ethics when you're dealing with your people as well. Like, you have to be able to, if I say I'm a black feminist, then there has to be a certain way that I treat black women, whether I like them or not, because liberation isn't just about the people that you like, unfortunately. So,
Exactly.
they're
Yeah.
gonna send my offering because you're preaching, but okay.
No, it's true.
You gotta
You got to
embody
be
the
about it.
politics. You gotta be about the communities. You can't say that you serve community or that you're for community engagement, and then you're not even a part of, don't respect, not really invested in the communities that you claim to represent. These
Yeah.
are problems. These are the problems.
It's true.
And I think there's things that can only be discussed in black spaces. Like, we don't discuss these things in mixed company.
Oh,
But
hello.
I,
Hello,
you know,
thank you. That's
y'all
the
might have to
thing.
edit that part out. I don't know.
No. We got you. We're picking up what you're putting down.
Yeah, but
So, what are some parting words that you would like to share with our audience?
I know that with all of the discussion around Black history, and even social science and its value to America and to broader society, I hope that we all take one thing with us, is that the power of thought, can change the way, not only the way people think, but also how people are compelled to treat one another, which has real world change for policies, for social interactions on an everyday basis, for how we interact with the broader global community, and the ways in which we treat each other undeniably shapes each next subsequent generation.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Love it. Dr. Brittany Brown, thank you so much for sharing with us and our listeners. Can you let them know where they can find out more about you and the work that you're doing?
Yes. So you can find me at the Black Archaeologist on Instagram. We're trying to get the TikTok and the YouTube together, but definitely on Instagram is my primary platform. So at the Black
Yes.
Archaeologist, and you can catch me there.
Awesome. And yes, I can definitely say she has a great Instagram page, great videos, very educational. So certainly give her a follow. To our listeners, we thank you for joining us and we look forward to sharing with you during our next segment of Speak On It.
Speak On It is a podcast and is immediately available to listen to at your leisure. Thank you.